man. There's a beverage here, huh?
Does anybody here know how many times I've had to watch Funny Lady?
I'm gonna get that gun of mine, and I'm gonna change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, If You Want Your Way, and in the booth with me this week, film reviews editor at The Wrap, Alonso Duralde. What's good?
Well, Iffy, it's beginning to look a lot like Christmas. I can now announce, because it is official, it's a thing. If you're anywhere near Edison, New Jersey, in the convention center,
and who isn't?
On the second weekend of November, come see me at Christmas Con.
Oh,
it is
wow.
The first ever con devoted to Christmas stuff, specifically Hallmark Christmas movies, because they have like all the biggies. Lacey Chabert is going to be there, Nikki DeLoach, Alicia Witt, Cameron Matheson, Jack Kay, Chad Michael Murray.
Oh,
it's
wow.
going to be a scene. And I am moderating a panel of Christmas podcasters, including our friend Dan, who's from Deck the Hallmark, who's been on the show, the Deck the Hallmark guys, but also the guys from Christmas Past and Can't Wait for Christmas. I'm going to be signing and selling copies of my book, of course. I'm going to be just super in my element.
If
I cannot wait for this
thing. If we get you a Christmas Zaddy sash, will you wear it?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Ooh, okay, all right. Well, me and Dre have some work to do.
I know. We're going to get our sash. Yeah. We'll have a crafter noon.
Yeah, yeah.
Ooh. We'll make him one.
But yeah, I can't believe no one's thought of Christmas Con before now.
No.
But
I know. I'm very
shocked.
They've thought of it. It's happening, and it's happening.
Ooh. And as all is right in the world, you're going to be there.
Yeah,
absolutely.
That's the like perfect cherry on top for all of it. And also, that other voice you hear is producer and film festival programmer, Dre Clark. What is good?
What is good is this weekend in Los Angeles, if you live in Los Angeles. So the Saturday after this comes out in September, I don't know what date today is. Anyway, I'm moderating a Q&A for the 1987 film Dudes.
Nice.
Which many people have not seen. The people who have seen it, I think most of them would agree, it is underappreciated.
Oh, sure.
It is a super strange punk rock road trip buddy comedy with John Cryer and Daniel Roebuck. And it's directed by my sweet buddy, Penelope Spheeris, goddess of all. And so the Q&A will be with her, with Daniel, with the writer and the producer. At a rooftop screening. So if you're in LA, come out to that and cheer. And it's also, I'm excited because it's punk rock themed, like dress up. And I'm an old lady and I'm still figuring out like, oh, what punk outfit can I put together?
Well, I
think
it's more of a cowpunk movie because it is a neo-Western.
The Western elements of it are easier for me. Mm. It's the punk stuff. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Ah.
That's good. I'm psyched. Hey, Iffy, what's good with you?
Oh, what's good with me? Well, this weekend, if you're listening to this, I'm already down in San Diego for TwitchCon. Speaking of cons specifically built for
us. I let you guys down. I should have done a con.
Yeah, I'll be doing the season finale of the sneaker show I've been doing for the past few weeks, Fresh Stock. And we'll be giving away those Air Fear of God 1s. I'll be bouncing around Blink-182's doing a performance, Lil Nas X. So I'll be shaking my booty, and I'm going to probably get real drunk and try that, like, egg challenge at that one. You've ever been down to San Diego? There's I think it's Breaking the Yolk or something. They have like a omelet that's like 50 eggs. Oh. And like if you eat it, it's free. And
what
I was
is
like,
it? No man can eat all those eggs from The Hustler?
Oh!
No, from Cool Hand Luke.
Cool Hand Luke! Sorry, Paul. Sorry, Paul Newman.
Oh, man. But speaking of movies...
Yes!
Today we're talking.
Segway.
That's why you're the host.
Today we're talking about Rambo Last Blood, and boy, do I have some thoughts. And then after that, we're going to be talking about fall movies, and of course, we'll have our staff picks. But first up, it's time for our new segment called Ididic, short for Is This Important? Do I Care? Each of us will read a news segment and answer the question, is this important? Do I care? And what isn't listed is the fact that Lindsay Lohan is single and said that she is looking for a partner. And I did a tweet about it, and someone replied, is this important? Do I care?
Cheers!
And
cheers
the answer
to you.
Is, yes, it is important, and I do care. You know,
don't feed the beast.
Can you imagine?
Aim higher, Iffy.
Look, we'll see. We'll see. But the news this week is the fact that the Jurassic Park crew is returning for Jurassic World 3. Deadline is reporting that the Holy Jurassic Triumvirate, otherwise known as Jeff Goldblum, Sam Neill, and Laura Dern, are all set to reprise their roles for Jurassic World 3. The last time they all appeared in the film franchise together was the original Jurassic Park back in 1993. Colin Trevorrow is returning to direct, and Bryce Dallas Howard and Chris Pratt are also reprising their roles from Jurassic World. Is this important? Do you care?
No. Not really. I'm sorry. I have not been enjoying the Jurassic World movies. I don't think they're interesting. I don't think Colin Trevor is doing a very good job with this franchise. And while it's nice that they're bringing back the OGs, they're not getting rid of Chris Pratt and Bryce Dallas Howard. So I'm not excited.
I'm interested in this. Did either of you watch the 8-minute short that they just did, that they released that Colin directed? It's online. I'd check it out. If only it's literally just like a scene from a movie. But if any of you missed the last Jurassic World, which many people did, it's bonkers because it is a haunted house movie. The dinosaurs are inside a house by the end. I'm not exaggerating. Yeah. The dinosaurs are inside a house. It's amazing. And then they escape. So the whole end of it is that the dinosaurs are like now amongst us in the rest of the world. And that's what the short is about, presumably about what the next feature is going to be about. And I like the idea of these three coming back. It's actually something we can dig into and will with Rambo, but there's something fun about seeing characters you knew a long time ago if they're integrated well in an interesting way. If I can catch up with Dr. Ellie Sattler and she's doing something so unique, and I think that they have a possibility of an angle in with that, with dinosaurs running rampant across the U.S.
Yeah.
They could totally drop the ball, and they've dropped the ball before.
Yeah.
But, you know, a girl has to have hope, Alonzo.
Look, I walk into every movie with the utmost, like, attempting some optimism.
Just giggles and bubbles.
Yeah, it's the nature of the beast. But, you know, just if you're going to ask me this far out, am I excited about a new Jurassic World movie, no matter who is coming back for it, if it's still going to be the same crew doing them, then I got to say no. I'm just not.
Yeah, for me, I will say I'm like right in the middle of y'all where like the end, I did not care for the last Jurassic World, but the ending was such a fun premise. Like you would, because this is kind of like, it's like, remember the problem we really have with Terminator is like, how many times are we going to try and stop the thing that's inevitable? Like that's, we're hitting that point, all this. And it kind of felt like the same way with the Jurassic World where it's like, we have to stop them from, like, let's see the next step, which is fun.
Which is, we didn't stop them.
True, yeah. Like, fuck it, part two. Who does have an appeal, I grant you.
Yeah.
Always. Yes.
So, okay, I'm not quite sure if I'm excited about this or not, but you guys can tell me. Deadline's reporting that Jason Bateman is in talks to direct a new live-action adaptation of Hasbro's Clue. Ryan Reynolds is also in talk to star and co-write the film with Bateman. You may and should remember, of course, the 1985 Tim Curry version of the film. Also, the really bizarre miniseries on The Hub, where it was a bunch of teenagers running around. And the Clue well is a popular one. Anyway, is this important? Do you care?
I care. Important, not sure yet. I love my Ryans, both Gosling and Reynolds. But Reynolds is starting to worry me because Reynolds is doing this thing where I think a lot of acts, like, for example, RDJ, Robert Downey Jr., he was great, beautiful, and then he sort of just kind of slowly became Tony Stark in a lot of like and everything. And I feel like that's where Reynolds is heading, where it's like everything is very Deadpool-esque. Like in Hobbs and Shaw, he was very Deadpool-esque. Yeah. And so if Clue is going to be that Ryan Reynolds, like where we're getting like that Deadpool-y kind of like, I'm smart.
But to me, I think I agree with you because it's never fun to see an actor just rehash the same bit over and over. It's interesting because Bateman's also going to be in this, and I don't know which of them would be playing the butler, which is the Tim Curry role. And I feel like Ryan Reynolds as a Colonel Mustard or something. Like, there's possibility that he's going to go a different route. There's also possibility that he's going to do the butler and he's going to go full Ryan Reynolds. But he has been making interesting choices as a producer as well. So again, in the sunshine and optimism of things, it's hard because I do think Clue is a lightning in a bottle film. It's something that the original cast and everything with it, like, even for, it's not like it's so luxuriously shot. It's very clearly like sound stages in a house and like short shooting. There's still magic to it. Yeah. And I think it will be difficult to recreate that in a contemporary way. I mean, if they set it in the same time, like our Cold War awareness, it dims each day. So there's things in there that are like not going to bounce in the same way.
As long as they don't pee in a fountain together, that's really all I ask. Now, I don't know. I mean, I think what's interesting about Clue, it's funny that it periodically comes up as a thing they're going to remake. Because I remember when it came out, the sort of general horror of like they're turning board games into movies now, and then that movie did bomb, let's not forget. It wasn't until
horribly,
you know, kids watched it a million times on HBO that we spawned a generation of people who love Clue all of a sudden. But what I think is interesting about the fact that it is a board game is that as a property, it can be anything.
Yeah.
You know, and you can do all kinds of tones with it. And, you know, we just had Ready or Not and we're getting Knives Out. And so, like, it could be a much darker Clue, a much more violent Clue, but still a funny Clue or not a funny Clue. It could be anything they want it to be. So as I'm glad that they don't. I mean, who knows? I'm assuming they don't feel like they have to remake the 85 version step by step, and that liberates them to some extent. So, you know, who knows? It could be anything.
Fingers crossed. I do like also that it's an adult movie. Like, it is a movie about and for adults, not in a creepy, boning kind of way.
No.
Although I'm sure Yvette will remain boobalicious. Not speaking of boobs. Sean Bean, you guys, I never have a good segue.
No.
Like, there's never. Ugh. Anyway, the actor Sean Bean, who's most famous for playing Boromir in Lord of the Rings and Ned Stark in Game of Thrones, is used to playing characters that die. In fact, if you watch the YouTube compilation, Sean Bean Dies in Every Movie, it's actually quite shocking how many times he's killed. It's also, if you start to type Sean Bean, it will autofill how dies in movie.
Like,
that's his thing. Anyway, according to a new interview with The Sun, he's over it. He's even said he's turned down roles where the character ends up dying. I've turned down stuff that I've said. They know my... I really want to do a Sean Bean, but I'll hold myself back. They know my character's going to die because I'm in it. I just had to cut that out and start surviving. Otherwise, it was all a bit predictable. I've played a lot of baddies. They were great, but they weren't fulfilling, and I always died. Is this important? Do you care?
I think it's interesting that he is cognizant of this, that he's not just making a career out of being the red shirt guy. Yeah, I guess I care. I mean, I to be honest, neither Lord of the Rings nor Game of Thrones is my jam, but hey, he was in Jupiter Ascending.
Oh my God, did he die?
He did.
Yes,
oh my
did.
Gosh.
What I like about this, I saw this headline and was like, yeah, I guess I'd get tired dying.
Yeah.
I feel that. But I do, as actors making choices of career-wise, there's something to say of the last thing I want is for an audience to know when they go into a movie that my whole character line is just blown up from the beginning.
It's like when Tony Houston pops up in Angel Has Fallen, and you're like, whoop. I know who the bad guy is now.
Yes. Yes. In any movie. Yeah.
Like the shocking reveal in Children of Men is that he isn't the bad guy. Because in everything else,
that's
always
true.
Always the bad guy.
What about you? Do you know Sean Bean?
Yeah, I'm familiar with the Bean. I think, you know, as an actor, you know, that is like an interesting thing, and that's
craft.
A good point, because there are those people who are like, when you see them, you're like, oh, that's like, you don't, the plot may not have given you anything, but you're like, I know for a fact you're the bad guy because you play bad guys. And sometimes it's just, it's that weird decision you have to make, because sometimes, like, yeah, I like when you play a bad guy. Like, you know, when sometimes they'll have, like, for example, when I went back and I saw Romancing the Stone, and Michael Douglas is the kind of Indiana Jones type, and I was like, I don't like him as this.
He's greedy.
Yeah. You need to be greedy.
He wants money.
Yeah. I don't like you being like the like Snarky. Yeah.
And he made that movie first.
Yeah.
Oh, that's true.
I went back and saw it after the Michael Douglas I know. And, like, it is funny where it's like, who knows, back then some people might have been like, this is our guy. But I was like, no, I don't like him as a good guy.
It's like when they cast somebody really famous in a seemingly insignificant role.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, well, you're coming back in Act 3 as a whole other thing.
Law and Order, every single time. I'm like, listen, your casting is throwing this for me. Okay, I have a related question for you guys. Iffy, I have no doubt that you have, like, a great volume of skills. I'm guessing Alonzo might do better, but this is a shot in the dark. So Sean Bean's died 25 times on camera, apparently,
okay,
which is a number. However, he's not the person who's died most as an actor, like character-wise.
Yeah.
Someone almost doubled that. Who do you think died the most on camera?
Is it one of those movies where somebody dies over and over again?
No.
Okay, nothing like...
Not like... It's Tom Cruise.
I was saying, Bill Murray in Groundhog Day. Yeah,
oh,
Tom
sure.
Cruise
no,
in
no.
Tomorrow.
No, it's like the character. Yeah.
Oh. Is it like Peter Lorre or somebody?
It's more towards that than
Claude
it is...
Claude Rains? I don't know.
Sean Bean. John Hurt died 47 times.
Wow.
Our younger audience will know him as... Ollivander from the Harry Potter films.
Ah, okay.
The guy who was from the wand shop.
The guy whose stomach explodes an alien.
There you go.
That is also one.
Yes.
Anyway, I liked that one.
His Quentin Crisp is amazing.
Ooh.
And he doesn't die.
All right. Well, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking about Rambo Last Blood just as soon as we hear from another one of the shows on Maximum Fun.
I'm Travis McElroy.
I'm Courtney Enlow.
I'm Brent Black, and we're the hosts of Trends Like These.
Trends Like These is an internet news show where we take the stories trending on social media and go beyond the headlines.
We'll give you the actual facts of the story and not just the knee-jerk reactions.
Plus, we end every episode with a ray of hope that we call the Wi-Fi of the week.
So join us every Friday on Maximum Fun.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
Trends Like These, real-life friends talking internet trends.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Iffy Wadiwe, and in the studio with me are...
Drea Clark.
Alonzo Duraldi.
And today we're talking about Rambo, Last Blood. Alonzo, please give us a synopsis of the film.
Okay, well, Sylvester Stallone is... Fuck this movie! Okay, sorry, no, we're gonna get to that later. Sylvester Stallone returns for the fifth time as John Rambo, who is now living on a ranch in Arizona, raising some horses and... taking his meds and building a lot of tunnels under the ranch house just because, you know, if you're a Vietnam vet dealing with PTSD, nothing makes you feel comfy like tunnels. He has a housekeeper played by the great Adriana Barraza, who deserves much better than this. She has a teenage granddaughter who finds out that her deadbeat dad is in Mexico, and she wants to go see him and confront him. And Rambo's like, no, Blackheart. And she goes, anyway...
Oscar!
Only to have her former best friend, who is a cartoon of a chola, sell her to slave traffickers, sex, terrible drug people. So Rambo has to go to Mexico and kill everyone, and then he gets the shit beaten out of him, but then he comes back to Arizona, and they come to him, and then he kills everyone. And is that a spoiler? I don't care, because
I was going to say, just off rip, I am... 100% going to spoil multiple parts of this movie, if not to save you from spending money on this.
Because what did you think was going to happen in this movie?
I think this is similar to similar and different, but to talking about like John Wick or something. Yeah. I don't think it's a spoil for us to say like, oh, a lot of people die and he will fight a lot of people and there'll be showdowns.
But I do want to talk about the arc that I kind of went into watching this, because this movie really, there was a clear moment to when I just... got turned off of the movie. It was a clear moment, and it was crazy thinking back on it, on how stark it was. Like, oh, I went from giving this a chance to I'm out. So it starts off, and he's like living on the ranch, and it really does kind of start off in a way that makes me think it's going to be about what was interesting to me was almost like the kind of Rocky Rambo, where Creed was kind of revisiting Rocky and kind of seeing how this character developed over time and kind of deconstructing it in a fun way and kind of putting it under a microscope and kind of, you know, really letting this character bloom as a human. Mm-hmm. And at the start of the movie, it kind of felt that way, even though there were just some, like, way too many shots of him on a horse, you know, and there was the tunnel. But it really did. I was like, oh, they're kind of painting him as this, you know, guy who has PTSD. It is an issue. He's obviously taking pills for it, but this younger generation is kind of trying to let him calm down, you know, let him get thing. And then also, like, there were like huge conversations he was having with the housekeeper. That relationship was weird to me because it seemed like they could have been dating, but
it was
they
who's
weren't.
The boss.
Yeah.
There's a whole will they won't they thing going on.
But there, that first initial conversation that they were kind of having before we get into like the meat of what you would want to call a plot, it seemed like, oh, this is, he's trying to do the Oscar swing like he did with Creed. Like, this is going to be like he's having these deep, pensive moments. And then...
Wait, before you end then, because I do think the beginning of it, I'm with you. I was going into it with the optimism that I do think you should approach movies with, or else you're just like killing yourself.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
But I was hoping, you know, I'm like, oh, all right, the idea of a veteran who has been tortured by these acts that he perpetrated, that he watched, that he's been suffering under, like the idea of coming out there, I was thinking, oh, is this going to have shades of like Logan?
Yes.
Like this older person who has gone through this very violent life and carries it as a burden, as an armor, as whatever. There's an interesting emotional story to be found there. And for the setup, I was like, huh? Okay, so sort of ridiculous, but fair enough. I remember First Blood, so no one's going to ever say it's not a ridiculous movie.
Yeah.
So I'm like, all right. And then I'm guessing I had a similar
breaking It's funny
point.
That you mentioned Logan, because both of those movies, I think, are really trying hard to be The Searchers. You know, they're really aspiring for that level of kind of like autumnal machismo and, like, you know, the American hero in his, you know, twilight years having sort of one last grand gesture, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Although, of course, it just reminded me how, like, the thing that Stallone and John Wayne have in common besides their iconography is the fact that they both made a career out of wars that they did not bother fighting
in.
John Wayne managed to sit out World War II in Hollywood. Stallone went to Europe and made softcore porn movies during Vietnam. And then they spent the rest of their careers flying the flag and shooting the guns and being the face of, like, you know, American jingoism. And it's like, oh, but when an actual war happens, you had somewhere else to be.
There's a deeper comparison to be made there. And I never thought of that, but I love you saying it, because John Wayne's trajectory and Stallone and how they envision what manhood and masculinity and American masculinity means was so specific to the both of them, and I think it shaped their careers in huge ways. And Stallone doing this again, like the ridiculousness of him digging these tunnels, but it's also the man is 73 and he's playing Rambo as this, like, he's to me bigger than I remember him being in First Blood. Like, he's huge and muscular in a way that I'm like, that does not come naturally.
It's
like,
so funny. Seeing all this reminded me of when, I forgot, I was in some writer's room and someone described Taken and like Tom Clancy novels as dad porn. And I was like, oh, and that just rung so true with me. It was like, there's like weird groaning, but there is like an old aging white man in Wherever'sville watching this and just has a huge boner through the whole movie.
He remembers a huge boner. Boner's gone
so
by.
So good. Yeah. Oh, yes.
Because, this is so, like, I mean, not just tasteless, but I believe you pretty much nailed it. If it's irresponsible filmmaking, yeah. It is so incredibly just. It just feels flagrantly racist.
Yeah.
Like it's not even commenting on racism or on the border.
No,
or
it's just doing it.
It's just like no. Those devil Mexicans will come get you.
Well, let's
look out.
I want to say the moment turned off. Moment I got turned off was when the dad was mentioned. And she was like, I need to go to Mexico. And they were like, Mexico, as if it was the worst thing.
Yeah.
And I was like, you don't even have the decency to try and find a city in this whole country to make it. It was just Mexico. And made even worse to when she drove into Mexico and there was a big sign that said Mexico in a red, white, and green building.
And the score gets foreboding.
Yeah.
And the minute she crosses the border, it's like,
mm-hmm. It truly was like, oh, this is bad. Like, I'm over here just literally the past few weeks been spending all this time trying to plan to make a trip to Mexico City, thinking about how beautiful it is and all the culture there. I actually have a friend who lives out there who like does coffee stuff and seeing the visuals out there. So to just see like someone's whole country painted in this way.
Yeah.
And then as someone who grew up in Compton, California, and definitely in the eye of the storm because I was like surrounded by all of the gangs and for some reason no one. So I've seen real life cholos and cholas, and none of the cholas I've ever seen in my life would be caught dead looking like that. Is like something that someone's going to get called out in a few weeks for dressing like at a Halloween party
or on SNL.
Yeah.
Cause like she's got the bump.
Yes.
She's got the blue eyeshadow, the hoops, the gold chains, the flannel shirt buttoned up to the neck. I'm like, where's the black lip liner? I mean, like, in for a penny, in for a pound.
Where
here, people.
The,
come on.
What is it? The razor blade in the...
Yeah.
It's thanks. Just like, you've got to be kidding me. And then, like, did you notice that every time someone goes from Mexico to the United States, they never do it legally?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
And it's also so easy.
It's so easy,
people
yeah.
can just do that. They can drive it in an afternoon. I totally agree. It's also... I found it even more irresponsible that I think that the filmmakers and Stallone thought they were absolving themselves from these things because they had female Latina characters that were not bad guys.
Yeah.
And in a way, to me, it exacerbated it. It was this,
oh
gross, the Band-Aid that you think it's putting on that, like, that you found these token, and it fits again into the sort of MAGA viewpoint
Mexican
of it, of like
men are all monsters,
right? But also that in any minority or underrepresented, that there's this exceptionalism that can be found, and so these women are fine, and I'll protect them till I die, Home Alone style.
Mm. Yeah,
but
Home Stallone, as Matt Singer said.
Oh, shut up! I love it, Home Stallone, I love it, but that. Then the men, and again, no, we are not people who are delusional about the drug cartel issues and violence in Mexico, but the broad painting of an entire country,
I mean,
the entire male demographic of a country.
And just like, just bombshell shitty lines, like when he was like, you're not going to call the cops, they can't do anything past the border, and no one over there is going to do shit. Like,
yeah.
I was like... It's to me, I looked at it and I was like, oh, this is just a dumber Gran Torino, and Gran Torino is fucking dumb. Like, I was so appalled at just how much of a caricature everyone is, where it's like, you know, one, the cartel thing has been so overdone, but then you can't even at least, you know, create the dad had no reason to be in the movie. Like, there was no reason other than being like, Mexican dads are bad.
Like, I mean, like, this guy is like Newt Gingrich level awful.
Yeah.
Like, not only did he abandon his wife when she was dying of cancer, but he tells his daughter to her face that he never wanted her and he didn't care about her. It's like, damn.
Yeah, like, it truly was like, and then there was like, why did we put this poor little girl through all this just to kill her?
The stupidity, all of the people are stupid, their choices are stupid, but the annoying part again is it no, it's all annoying, but it translates to the filmmaking as well, because it's one of, this is a supremely violent film that gets more and more violent as it goes. Yeah. And we are definitely people, the glee with which I watched John Wick 3 and was like, yes, stab that other guy. Yeah. And, but that, I had to
laugh like when he drops a head,
no, the head
out the window of his truck on the highway.
Well, that, and it's funny that you mentioned John Wick, because this was the movie that let me know that I'm human, because I can like laugh
sure.
at John Wick and the way he kills people, and I just was like wincing at the, because with me it was like, it just, it never, I was never on his side. I was, it just felt bad. All I can think of is just this essential message that anyone can take out this movie was, don't go to Mexico because they'll be sex trafficked. Yeah. And like, I was like, there was
they'll shoot heroin into your eyeballs.
Yeah. Until you, like, it was just really did feel like, someone can take one of like Trump's shitty speeches and like play things he says about Mexicans and find a scene for every sentence he has. And that's what was scary to me. Because it's like one thing, because Stallone isn't the first to do a bad portrayal of Mexican cartels and sure. But it's these how similar, like he literally made a movie about Mexicans being drug dealers and rapists. Like that's what the movie
that's
is.
That's not even the subtext, it's the text.
Yeah.
It's the text.
And the thing about Rambo is that like, and there have been a lot of think pieces about how this has always been this sort of like weird Rorschach blot of like the moment that it comes out. So like the original First Blood, I believe it's like early 80s, it's still that sort of holdover of the 70s. And it's a movie about how we basically treated the Vietnam vets like shit and how there wasn't an infrastructure to take care of them and this one guy gets pushed too far. And it's very much in the sort of the Rolling Thunder school of like post-Vietnam cinema. Then you get Rambo First Blood Part 2, which is like super Reagan, rah-rah. We're going to rewrite the history of the Vietnam War and we're going to kick the shit out of everybody because we're Americans, you know? Yeah. And then you've got 3, which is like super entrenched in the Cold War and is so hardcore anti-Soviet, even if it means being pro-Mujahideen. Way to go, guys. Then 4 is, I don't even know what the fuck 4 is, except it's like, you know, foreign policy bad, everyone evil, I don't know what. And then this one, it is this like, this MAGA bullshit with the added bonus of like, we're gonna bring back Rambo one last time and turn him into Jigsaw. Like the entire third act is so like creepily sadistic.
Yeah.
Even though you want the bad people to get the bad thing coming to them, you're right, it's so awful you can't even root for Rambo because like, oh, you're a sick fuck.
Yeah.
So I saw Rambo First Blood long ago and probably a few times since. I never saw any of the other sequels. And so for me, it was even a broader leap to this. And like I said, there are story elements that I think could have been really interesting to get into. And I like the return. Actually, no, that's a lie. I must have seen another because I remember it going into different countries. And this one, I liked the idea of having a more insular story. First Blood is this guy, he's a drifter, a very well-built drifter who wanders into this small town in like Washington and gets up against the local cops and then the FBI comes. Like that story, the smallness of it made it so much more, it's not relatable at all, but you know what I'm saying.
Sure. Yeah.
And the idea of, what if we layered that on today? Like, he could have gone back to the same town today and redone those things. There could have been something about how vets are, like, he's probably not on his meds because the VA backup is so terrible.
Yeah, I mean, or even, like, he could have come in to try and help out a situation, which another vet was going through something like he did in the first movie and sort of, you know, closed the loop or something.
Yeah.
There are a lot of ways they could have gone with this, sure.
He's not misunderstood at all. He is the law. Like, the first one, the law, like, it's just, it's lawless. And
yeah.
I
guess the last thing we can do is rate this thing, which I know y'all are at the edges of your seat wondering what we're going to say.
What will we
say? Yeah.
Well, obviously, I'm going to screen it, you guys. See it in 3D. Yeah, bring your whole family. No, this is a skip it. There's better films. Better films is an understatement. We just spent 20 minutes explaining why you should skip it. If I haven't convinced you by now, I never will.
Skip it hard. Skip it often. This is lukewarm garbage. I would say it's the worst film of the year, but I haven't seen The Fanatic yet. But
I have.
It's one of the worst films I've seen this year for sure.
Yeah, I'm a do my skip it. I don't give skip it's like lightly. I always try and give things a chance. But this is truly, like, we talk about the Joker being dangerous. I think this is more dangerous than the Joker, and it's definitely skip it. This is just fuel in the fire, and if anything, this is dehumanizing to Mexican people. Like, just straight up, it says there's no reason to like them. They're most likely trying to get behind you. There's no ulterior motives. We don't even see why the friend sells out her own friend. There was not even an exchange of money. She just did it to do it, which is what I think a impressionable person in the middle of nowhere who's never met someone who's Mexican would take from that. Skip it. And I mean, even skip it if it's on TV. Skip it when it's on Netflix.
Skip it at Redbox.
Skip it at Redbox. Any chance you can skip it, go out of your way to skip it. If you hear a movie theater discussing whether to run it another week, step in and say don't. Skip the hell out of this. Jeez, I never, man, I don't like many, there aren't many movies I don't like, and this is one of them.
But hey, Downton Abbey beat it over opening weekend box office, so fuck you, Stallone!
What is a weekend?
Exactly.
We'll be right back after we hear from another show from Maximum Fun.
Hey everybody, this is J. Keith Van Stratton, host of Go Fact Yourself, a live game show here in the Maximum Fun Network. On Go Fact Yourself, we take the smartest people we know and make them look dumb.
Paul, by the way, how much do you know about chicken husbandry?
You gotta give him that grain.
All right,
gotta give him that grain.
And then smart again.
What future Hall of Fame pitcher for the Cleveland Indians became the first active player to enlist?
Bob Feller.
Oh, okay.
We've got me, co-host Helen Hong, plus celebrity guests and actual surprise experts.
All right, we have an expert on hand who can tell us for sure.
Is it Alan Havey?
Helen, who do we have tonight?
Alan Havey!
Alan Havey!
In the coming weeks, you can hear guests like Maria Bamford, Tom Bergeron, Paul F. Tompkins, Janet Varney, and Grant Imahara. Check us out on the first and third Friday of every month here on the Maximum Fun Network.
Welcome back to Who Shot You? I'm your host, Sifu Wadiwe, and in the studio with me are...
Alonzo Duraldi.
Drea Clark.
And as of September 23rd, it is officially fall, so grab your flannel, crunch some leaves, and chug some PSLs, that's pumpkin spice lattes, because we're talking about fall movies. We want to discuss fall movies. Like, what makes a good fall movie, you know?
I'm glad you knew PSLs, because I took a second, and all I could think was... VPL, which is visible panty line, and I was like, wait,
that's what my autumn
right
is
either.
All about.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Does that seem autumnal to people?
Yeah, you know, you get those fluffy sweaters and those tight yoga pants, and you get those VPL.
Oh my God. That was my fault. I put us on that track. I feel like a good fall is a funny time for movies because it's wonderful for set deck. You get those beautiful colors,
Oh, yeah.
Get all of the trees, and then like wardrobe gets to bundle people up, and there's something so cozy about that. And it's great for, but also I've never shot in the fall because I always end up shooting in LA somehow.
Yeah.
We don't have a fall. I can't imagine continuity. That's all I can think of.
Yeah.
when I'm thinking of movies that, like for me, Far From Heaven has a ton of scenes outdoors in the most beautiful, like just the trees that you drive for.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's the Julianne Moore and Dennis Habert and
Dennis Quaid. Dennis Quaid. Yeah,
yeah, two Dennises. I didn't know they got all the Dennises, the Deni in that. but it had a... I think a lot of fall movies have a back to school element
to
them.
Sure, yeah, totally.
It had that kind of, obviously they were grown, but there was so much outdoor stuff with all of those leaves.
It's funny because one of the first times I sort of learned about like how movies fake things when I was like in junior high, Alan Alda shot the autumn segment of The Four Seasons. Partially in Atlanta. Like they used Agnes Scott College there to be like some sort of nameless, you know, New England Ivy University type thing. And they shot in the spring, so they had to dump all these dead leaves on the ground to fake it. And I remember reading about that being like, oh, Movies are lying to us all the time.
That's all they're doing.
Yes.
Lies.
Just moving lies, moving pictures of lies.
But, you know, that's obviously, you know, it is one of the four seasons. That's got a nice fall chunk in it. Hannah and Her Sisters is a movie that I think about, even though, like, it's not set entirely in the fall, but it keeps coming back to these Thanksgiving moments.
Yeah.
And I you know, that is very much like people in very nice sweaters.
Yes, the very nice sweaters. Go ahead.
Oh, no. I was just going to say, mine was just a turn of, like, autumn movies to me, like, the two, I think, seasons of movie for me usually are summer and winter. And then autumn movies always seem to coincide with a lot of horror movies, like Halloween.
Sure. Mm.
Halloween has a lot of nice shots of the autumn right before things just
get bloody.
Yeah. Oh, and Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, which we just talked about a while back.
Sweet.
Very autumnal.
Yeah. The Dead Poets Society.
Oh my God!
I remember having
such
a. It's there's school elements, and it's not just in the fall, but there's something about the crispness of it.
Yeah.
And they had all those like layered the sweaters with the blazer with the whatever with the captain, my captain. And this is maybe just because of the poster design, because one of their biggest moments is at New Year's, but when Harry Met Sally.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like, I know it starts at them leaving school, so that's in the spring. I know that there's all these, but they're, you know, a lot of their conversations, I just remember.
Yeah, there's that really long walk in Central Park with all the leaves, and sure.
Those are the leaves that, as a producer, would kill me. They would be the end of me.
One of the questions we have, I'm curious to y'all's thought on this, but are there any filmmakers that thrive in the fall season?
Other than horror?
I know. Oof.
You know, it's funny. I would think that Whit Stillman would be an autumn filmmaker, but I can't think of any examples of autumn in his movies. Like, Metropolitan is all December. Barcelona is fairly summery, if I recall.
Damsels
in Distress, but that's another school movie, you know.
There's Damsels in Distress. That's an underrated. Not enough people saw that. No, I'd agree with you. Whit Stillman's vibe has a, but it's also because you don't, like, LA-based filmmakers don't have the, we don't have a fall. And so.
I know, I just assign fall to movies. Like, for me, like, The Big Lebowski feels like a fall movie because that's the only time you can walk around with a robe like that and not be hot as hell.
Oh, what's the movie where Brad Pitt fly fishes?
Oh, Legends of the Fall.
Is that Legends of the Fall? No, that's
A River Runs Through It.
A River Runs Through It. That's
it.
Yeah. A River Runs Through It.
Yes.
Super autumny, as I recall.
I feel like Legends of the Fall.
I would also have something. Yeah.
This again is maybe more of a school thing, but Good Will Hunting.
Oh yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Right.
Well, school's always a good one because
how about them apples? Apple picking. You guys, that's a fall activity. That's just science. I just scienced you.
Yeah. Apple cider donuts.
Ooh.
There is, I don't think it has been released on Blu-ray in the U.S. ever, but I remember seeing this movie when it came out in theaters in the 90s. Toward the end of his career, the great French filmmaker Eric Rohmer throughout his career, he had what he would call like cycles. There are like certain films like this is the Comedies and Proverbs, and this is the blah, blah, blah. And then he had what he called the Tales of the Four Seasons, and he did a Tale of Winter, Tale of Spring, Tale of Autumn, and Tale of Summer.
Oh, nice.
And Tale of Autumn is really beautiful, and it's about these older friends who go on these like vineyard tours, and so like, you know, the vineyards are all like at that point of year where the harvest is happening and the leaves are turning color. And he is sort of notorious for being a filmmaker who relies very heavily on dialogue, but his visual sense is also, I think, A+.
For sure.
And so, Tale of Autumn just gives you all of Matt Pivovarczyk, who's been on the show, who's from the All Things Cozy podcast, has actually written about how his favorite Hallmark movies are the fall ones, the fall harvest, because he calls them just flat out season porn.
Nice.
Because
you don't need a holiday to hang your hat on.
Exactly. Yeah, like the Christmas movies, the Valentine movies, they have a specific thing. The fall movies, just like there's a hayride and we drink cider and there's some apples being picked.
Yeah.
And that's
it's cold
enough.
You have to sit close to the people you're interested in. Sure.
Yeah.
I feel like Beautiful Girls had a fall element.
Yeah.
That was actually shot very near my hometown in Minnesota, and which is an area that people drive to for foliage. Oh my God, isn't there Autumn in New York? Isn't there a film?
Yeah, it's not good, but
no, it's not good.
It is a film.
It's like the Richard Gere Winona Ryder.
Yeah. I think, it's funny, you know, I've talked about how there are movies that have a Christmas moment just as a way to imply the passage of time.
Yes.
And I think, like, a scene with leaves will accomplish the same thing.
Yes.
You know?
Oh, actually, to that end, Notting Hill. And their whole tracking shot of all of the seasons.
That's an amazing
montage.
You can have
any season you like, and Notting Hill will have fulfilled it.
I mean, Fantastic Mr. Fox, ooh, I think of as having kind of an autumnal color scheme.
Oh, for sure, the color scheme.
Yeah.
That's the exact, like, it's the exact oranges and mustards.
Exactly, yeah.
Also.
Oh, Fly Away Home.
Oh, my God. Wait, is that a kid? Is there a kid in animals?
That's one where Anna Paquin has to teach the ducks how to migrate.
Stop it.
Or the geese or whatever.
Yep. That is flooding back for me. My favorite book growing up was Make Way for Ducklings.
Oh, yeah.
So, you guys, ducks, who knew? I've always had a real soft spot.
Yeah. Ducks is the
way. Fly Away Home, yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so you're right. Anything that's either, like, about school starting up or about, like, you know, the harvest or the migration. Like, there's all these sort of natural things that you know, the season cycle takes us to. And so the movies tend to be kind of, you know, warm, and there's sort of an acknowledgement of death, but as part of a grander scheme.
Right, not the finality of winter.
Exactly. Yeah.
But just, like, a richness of the soil.
There you go. The loam.
Very beautiful, very beautiful. But now it's time for our staff picks. It could be any movie, in theaters, streaming, what have you. Alonzo, how about you start us off this
week? Okay, well, Downton Abbey doesn't need me to plug it, but it's a delight. what I am going to plug is a new documentary called Where's My Roy Cohn? Which is from director Matt Tiernauer, who recently gave us Scotty and the Secret History of Hollywood and Studio 54. And this is about Roy Cohn, who was a son of a bitch, one of the monsters of the 20th century, and who, you know, played a hand in some of the most awful things to happen in this country in the 20th century. He began his law career as a sidekick to Joe McCarthy during the HUAC hearings. He helped Ronald Reagan get into office. He defended a lot of mobsters. He was eventually disbarred for being such a total scumbag, even in the eyes of other New York lawyers. Denied that he was gay and denied that he had AIDS until the moment of his death. Was despicable. And the movie wisely does not try and make him likable or to explain him or rationalize him in any way. But I did even learn a lot about things that I did not know about Roy Cohn. I thought I kind of had the whole scoop. So it is a fascinating glimpse at how one human being can be such a complete shitheel.
There's more terribleness to discover.
Yes.
Wonderful.
Ooh, boy. What about you, Dre?
I don't care if it doesn't need my help. Downton Abbey still gets my vote. I love the show. And weirdly, I say that having skipped the last season entirely, and it didn't matter. I enjoyed coming back home to it. I love that world, and I think Julian Fellowes did a really nice job of shaping it into feature form, which doesn't surprise because he also made Gosford Park, one of my other favorites of a similar ilk. Oh, wait, maybe I should just say Gosford Park.
Well, Gosford Park did inspire Downton Abbey in the first
place.
There
you go. I'm going to change it. I'm going to sound a little more deeper cut. Gosford Park. Gacy, change me. Gosford Park.
It's a Robert Altman movie.
Well, me, I'm going to go another deep cut.
Wait.
Julian Fellowes wrote it.
Oh,
Robert Altman wrote it.
Oof, I got so nervous.
Relax, it's good.
I'm going to go with another deep cut. Continuing my tradition to make my pick based on something said in the episode and earlier when we were, I think it was during Itadick, you were talking about the punk movie. That was a little too punk for you. And so another rock-inspired movie by Japanese rock band Guitar Wolf Wild Zero, a comedy horror film. It's a zombie film where the band Guitar Zero gets put in a zombie apocalypse and they have to fight their way out. And, you know, this is also me encouraging you to check out, you know, J-Punk and J-Metal. It's a fun, wild ride. It's not bad. You know, it has 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, 3.4 out of 5 on Letterboxd, and 6.4 out of 10 on IMDb. Those are like slightly those are all over the place. Like, I was trying to make it, I was like, no, those are all over the place.
Have you seen Houssou by chance?
No.
Oh, iffy.
Okay, I'm going to check it out. That's definitely on the
a
list.
A staff pick within a staff
yeah,
pick.
Yeah. All right, y'all. Now it's time for the five-star reviews. If you leave us a five-star review on Apple Podcasts, we'll read it on air. And this one is from Big Baby Pudding Snatcher. This is a don't-miss podcast for me each week. I derive great pleasure from hearing film nerds properly nerd out and generally make spot-on observations. The variety of voices here makes this one of the best sources of pop culture conversation I've come across. This is important, and I do care. Ooh,
nice.
So well played, Big Baby Pudding Snatcher.
Five-star reference.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well played.
Thank you so much.
Yes, and
Big
thank
Baby
you.
Big Baby Pudding Snatcher.
Thank you, Alonzo, Andre, you know, for coming on every week.
No, thank you.
Me.
Thank you,
yeah,
sir.
Yeah, no, it's been...
Thanks to all of us. Here, here.
Yeah, yeah, here. Here. Back pats all around. Yes, yes. If you have a comment or suggestion on this week's show, tweet at us at WhoShotYouPod. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/WhoShotYouPodcast or send us an email at WhoShotYou@MaximumFun.org. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.